Welcome once again to our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. As Catholics, you know, we believe that the Church is the mother of the Bible, and that the Bible is the daughter of the Church. So we were also told by Vatican Council II, quoting St. Jerome, to be ignorant of the Scriptures is to be ignorant of Christ. So anything we can learn more about the Bible, we're talking really about the history of interpretation now, is a means of helping us appreciate this most wonderful book in the world. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School, teaches apologetics and Bible. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus of St. Patrick's here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. Ron, welcome once again. We're on our 29th series. We've been going through the interpretation of the Bible in different sections. We just completed the section on during the Reformation, how interpretation tended to switch back from the allegorical or the spiritual or the foreshadowing from the Old into the New Testament, like the Red Sea opening as a sign or a type of baptism for a Christian going through the water of baptism out of slavery of sin into the promised land of a new creature of God. So we're up to the 17th century, major developments in biblical interpretation at that time. So would you want to sort of start from there?
Yes, as we discussed during the 16th century, Protestant scripture scholars and Catholic ones, to some extent, came to the realization that it was necessary to compare the various ancient translations of the Bible with the original text in order to eliminate the mistakes that had crept in over the centuries by copyist errors or sometimes, you know, on purpose. Recall that we discussed Origen's 3rd century Hexapla earlier in this series, which placed side by side 6 versions of the Old Testament for the purpose of comparing text. Coming to the 17th century, scholars at Alcala, I believe that's in Spain if I recall right, Antwerp, which is in Belgium, and Paris, of course, France, and London, England, prepared what were called polyglot Bibles, which were folio editions with Hebrew, Samaritan, Greek, Syriac, and Latin text of the Bible in parallel columns. You know, a folio is a big book, a real big, you know, like a, what, maybe 2 feet by 3 feet or something like that.
Something like an accountant's
book. Yeah, like a big accountant's book, yes. Book. The invention of the printing press made it possible for copies to be distributed to biblical scholars everywhere. In other words, they didn't have to be copied out by hand, of course, which would have been a very laborious and very, very expensive process and very time-consuming process. But with the printing press, of course, they could, with movable type, these big folios could be printed out in much greater numbers and, of course, distributed to numerous Catholic and Protestant biblical scholars throughout Europe. And, I might add, in the New World as well. Although there were several outstanding scholars involved with this task, including Catholic and Protestants alike, undoubtedly the greatest was the Catholic biblical scholar Richard Simon, or I think in French it would be Ricard Simon.
All right, what can you tell us about Richard Simon? Because he seems to have had a great influence at this time in the 17th century.
Simon was born in 1638 and entered the Oratory, which was a congregation of secular priests. There he learned Greek, Hebrew, Syriac, and Arabic, which of course are all necessary, of course, in being a biblical scholar of original, you know, text. And he read all the important works on the Bible then available, at least that he, you know, he could get his hands on. A thorough knowledge of these languages is necessary to undergo biblical research, as we pointed out in one of our earlier sessions toward the beginning of this series. After many years of study, he published a book entitled A Critical History of the Old Testament, for which he was to receive a considerable criticism. He was soundly criticized by such great churchmen as Bossuet for claiming that Moses could not have been the sole author of the Pentateuch. We've spent a couple of sessions talking about that whole issue. For example, he could not have written the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy because it describes his death and burial. He makes reference to other similar inconsistencies in other parts of the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible, as we indicated earlier, which caused Bossuet, who was a French theologian of the time, a great one I might add too, and others to severely criticize him.
He was sort of the Bishop Sheen in his oratory of the time, I believe.
Oh yes, he was really quite an orator, a preacher. Toward the end of the 17th century, he published his Critical History of the New Testament, where he discusses the various Hebrew, Samaritan, Greek texts and their transmission from generation to generation. Also, he discusses various translations of the Old Testament, such as the Septuagint, other Greek versions, various Latin, Arabic, and Syriac translations, the Jewish Targums, as well as modern vernacular versions. So he wrote on a lot of different subjects of a biblical nature. The Targum, for example, was an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Bible, Tanakh, written or compiled during the Second Temple period until the early Middle Ages. That Second Temple, of course, was the so-called Temple of Ezekiel. The First Temple, of course, was the Temple of Solomon. The second was the Temple of Ezekiel, and the third, of course, was Herod's temple. His monumental work proved that it was necessary for scholars to do serious textual criticism. And finally, in this book, he outlined the basic principles that scripture scholars should follow while doing biblical criticism. And in this latter part of the book, he analyzed the scholarship of some of the church fathers, describing their limits, and he criticizes Protestant scholars for ignoring the role of tradition in biblical scholarship. In spite of its considerable merits, the Critical History was banned, mainly due to the influence of Bossuet. Even though he was severely criticized by Bossuet, a French bishop and great preacher of the day, as Monsignor said a while ago, Simon laid the foundation for modern biblical criticism. And he went on to write and publish a Critical History of the New Testament in which he deals with the text, translations, and commentaries that were in existence during that time.
Okay, hasn't some people called Simon the father of modern biblical criticism or modern critical analysis, which means the same thing as criticism?
Yes, they have. The French biblical scholar Jean Steinman made a great tribute to Simon when he wrote in his biblical criticism, quote, "Richard Simon's genius shed fresh light on all three branches of biblical criticism, textual, literary, and historical. He foresaw most of the problems facing the scholars of today. His knowledge was vast. And if he did not always point to the right solutions, he often prepared the way for them. Above all, he was the first to realize and declare openly that the Catholic Church had nothing to fear, quite the contrary, in fact, from critical work. He knew that critical study of the Bible would lead to the recognition of the sterling word tradition in the transmission and even in the actual formation of the canon of Scripture. His general views on the importance of literary forms in the Bible may have scandalized Bossuet, but today they are recognized as the fruit of a lively feeling for truth. It was a tragedy for the truth in France. Bossuet vanquished Richard Simon," end of quote.
Okay, so a real forerunner of the modern biblical analysis of the text, make sure that it's as close to the original as possible, to the literary forms, parable, story, metaphor, poetry, and analysis of the geography and the cultural history in which it was written. Is that what we're saying? He was really the forerunner of this biblical analysis that has become so important and really caused an awful lot of problems and conflict in our own time.
This John Steinman that I mentioned that I was quoting from there in his book, Biblical Criticism, this book is a part of a series of 150 books of called the 20th Century Catholic Encyclopedia, I think, edited by Andre Daniel Ropes, who's one of my favorite Catholic historians. In fact, we mentioned his book a couple of sessions ago on Jesus and His Times, which I think is one
that was to be a harmonization.
Yes.
Trying to put all the four Gospels together to make him flow as one
and
story.
Tell basically the life of Christ, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, we're coming to a point now, the Enlightenment, which caused really serious problems and still present many problems to us. So, Ron, say something about biblical interpretation during the Enlightenment period, which would be, let's say, the 18th century.
Yeah, about the mid-17th all the way through the 18th centuries, I guess, if you'd have to narrow it down. Sometimes the 17th century is called the Age of Reason, and the 18th century is called the Enlightenment period. Sometimes they're just sort of lumped together by some historians. But yes, this is one of the most important periods. This is when you really see the real change. And not only change in biblical scholarship, but changes in just about everything else.
Thinking in general.
It's the emergence of the modern way of looking at things, as to oppose to the more traditional way of looking at things.
And the modern way of looking things, we would say, is categorized by Pope Benedict XVI, that we live in an age of the dictatorship of relativism, that there is really no truth that we can come to. It just each depends upon one's individual way of thinking about
it. Yeah, and we're going to trace that through in some detail and then apply it, of course, to biblical scholarship as we go along. So it's going to take us probably a good five or six half-hour sessions to take care of the late 17th and 18th centuries.
Okay, well, give us a little beginning on the so-called Enlightenment, and the so-called, we say, because it caused awful lot of confusion and clear thinking from a Catholic viewpoint. Say something about the Enlightenment of the 18th century.
Well, during that time, we saw the greatest departure of biblical scholarship from the past, Catholic and Protestant alike. A little background of the period is necessary, I think, to understanding how it affected the interpretation of the Bible. One scholar said that the core of the age was the questioning of traditional institutions, such as the economic, political, and educational institutions, as well as the family and the church. The Enlightenment was a late 17th and 18th century phenomenon that was no doubt stimulated by the Renaissance humanism and the Protestant revolt against the Catholic Church, both of which we looked at briefly with respect to biblical interpretation. Also contributing to the Enlightenment were the discoveries in the New World and elsewhere, as well as new knowledge acquired by scientists in geology, geography, archaeology, ethnology, and other fields, which began to give men of the period a new perspective regarding time and space. The Enlightenment was in the main a philosophical movement that first developed in France, Britain, and Germany, and spread throughout Europe and eventually to North and South America and other parts of the world. The period was especially marked by independence movements and the creation of new nations, such as the United States. Major political changes in existing nations, such as France, greater rights for the common people, and the decline of the influence of the nobility and religion. The emphasis was placed on the use of reason in the search for truth, rather than tradition or divine revelation. The leaders of the Enlightenment believed that they could stimulate progress in the human condition after what they considered, quote, a long period of tradition irrationality, superstition, and tyranny, which they imputed to the Middle Ages, end of quote. Many historians and philosophers believe that the Enlightenment stimulated the later rise of classical liberalism, socialism, democracy, and modern capitalism.
Okay, so an emphasis on using reason and reason alone, sort of just pushing to the back burner what has traditionally been believed or what the Bible had said especially. So all of it wasn't bad, but there was an awful lot of mixture of erroneous ideas.
There's nothing wrong with using reason to help interpret the Bible. I mean, after all, that's what you have to do. That's what Origen did. That's what St. Augustine did. St. Jerome did. St. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages. What Ricard Simon or Richard Simon did, and whoever else. They used their reason, human reason, which is a God-given faculty of the soul, of the intellect.
And Pope John Paul the Great has written a wonderful encyclical on faith and yes. reason.
Well, the problem is, with the Enlightenment period, though, and from then on, they began to replace faith totally with reason in a search for truth. Or replace the Bible, replace tradition, replace sacred tradition with reason only. So, replace it, not just use it to understand reason or revelation of the Bible better, but to totally replace it.
The Church has always defended that there is no contradiction between faith and reason, or science and faith. But what happened in the Enlightenment, you're seeming to say, is they just knocked out revelation and traditional understanding of the Bible. And if it made sense, fine. If it didn't, it had to go.
It didn't happen overnight. You know, it took, as you're going to see, as we're going to see, when we look at some of these philosophers like René Descartes, he was still a religious man. Even Immanuel Kant in the 18th century was still a religious man. John Locke was a very religious man. We're going to look at some of these people. Sir Isaac Newton, of course, was a very religious man. It wasn't long before there were people who came along who began to strip their ideas of the religious content.
Okay.
And we're going to trace that through. So.
All right. Well, who were some of the leaders of this period of the Enlightenment, the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the 18th century?
Well, as to who are the most important people of the period, I think it depends on which historians you read. Certainly the Frenchman René Descartes that I mentioned a while ago was one of the most seminal thinkers in the early part of the Enlightenment. Sometimes he's considered a part of the so-called Age of Reason, which some historians believe preceded the Enlightenment. Other rationalist philosophers of the early period include Benedict Spinoza, who we talked about quite a bit in our series on apologetics, and we're going to talk about quite a bit in this series. And Gottfried Leibniz. Later French rationalists included Voltaire, Denis Diderot, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The British empirists include men such as Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, George Berkeley, and David Hume. And I must also mention the great the German idealists such as Immanuel Kant of the 18th century, and Arthur Schopenhauer. Johann Gottfried Fichte, and Friedrich Schelling, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, and some others. We're not going to talk about every one of these, but we're going to look at several of them. They tried to synthesize, people like Hegel tried to synthesize the conflicting philosophical views of their day. Of all these men, Thomas Hobbes, René Descartes, John Locke, Benedict Spinoza, David Hume, and Immanuel Kant are the most important in regard to biblical scholarship. So these are the ones.
Okay, so just to kind of clarify where we are, there was the traditional understanding of Scripture as interpreted by the Church as genuine revelation, and then along comes the Age of Enlightenment, which was saying that reason has to replace. Now, they didn't, as you mentioned, didn't say it right away, but we want to emphasize reason in interpreting the scriptures, because otherwise we get into what you quoted as saying irrationality, superstition, and tyranny, which was imputed to the Middle Ages, are guiding our lives by the star of Bible revelation. So these people, some were very anti-Catholic. I remember mentioning Voltaire called the church the infamous thing, and he wanted it, he was out to destroy it, and he was a brilliant person, and he ridiculed and attacked, as many of the atheists today. Was Voltaire actually an atheist?
Probably a deist.
Okay.
One who believed that there was a God, and that this God designed the universe, this architect, put it into place, created it, but then stepped back and had nothing to do with it, and had no interest in it. He probably came closer to that than just an outright atheist, one who didn't believe in God at all.
Well, I know you mentioned Spinoza many times before, and his methodology seemed to be spread doubt by raising questions and then finally undermining the whole structure. It's kind of like a termite.
Yes, and we're going to spend quite a bit of time, as we suggested in that series, which we did look at a little bit into it. We're going to look at him a little more detail in this series.
Okay, but you did mention, and I wasn't aware of that, that Kant and the Frenchman Descartes were actually religious people. And they weren't out to destroy. They were trying to clarify, talk to the modern mind and the like.
Yeah, they really thought they were saving religion.
Okay.
But as it turned out, they were really contributing to its demise.
Okay. Well, what are some of the ideas of these men, well-intentioned or not well-intentioned, with regard to religion, that are so important in bringing about a change in biblical study or biblical scholarship of that period of the Enlightenment?
Well, I need to give a little background to answer this question. The most basic question in all of philosophy for all time has been, does a real world exist apart from our knowledge of it? Repeat that.
Okay, because it's so important. That's really a very on the front burner today.
Yes,
many people say we cannot know the truth outside of us.
Yes, does a real world exist apart from our knowledge of it? And what this really means is there a reality or a truth that exists outside of our minds? And the reason the Enlightenment was such a departure from the traditional view, as you suggested a while ago, was that it offered a new answer to this question. The traditional view was that the mind and reality are in conformity with each other. Father John Harden, whom we've quoted many times, one of the greatest, catechists and theologians in the Catholic Church until his death in 2000, in his Pocket Catholic Dictionary defines truth as, quote, conformity of mind and reality, end of quote. This was St. Thomas's, Aquinas's definition of reality or truth. Father Harden tells us that, strictly speaking, reality includes, and I'll quote from him, the whole objective order of things. It comprises both things actually existing and things capable of existing. It is synonymous with being in the substantial sense. That's, of course, some scholastic terminology there that we won't get into. Well, being is simply that which is capable of existence. It's synonymous with a thing or something. When we say being, you know, we mean something or a thing, something that has being. The Church has always taught us that we can know things with certainty that exist outside of our minds, our consciousness, by using our senses and powers of intellect. And this philosophy is known as realism, or in Catholic circles, Aristotelian or Thomas realism.
Okay, now I think the next sentence stressed this because it's pretty important, Ron.
Well, after the Enlightenment, the dominant philosophy was that we can't know anything with certainty outside of our minds, our consciousness. All that we can know for certain is our own thoughts. This way of looking at things is called idealism, because it holds that all we can know are ideas, not things in themselves. The point is that if we can't know anything outside of our minds with any degree of certainty, how can we know what is described in the Bible is true? And the only answer is that we can't. Or God must infuse the knowledge directly into our intellects, one or the other. In fact, we can't even be sure that God exists.
Okay, so it underlined the whole idea, traditional idea of Catholic philosophy and theology, that we can know. There's a tree out there. Not just that I think there's a tree out there, but there may not be. And many people, you know, have said, I think correctly, that this destroys mathematics. We can't know two apples and two apples make four apples, because we don't even know if there's four apples out there. Or, much more practical, I can't do any business because I don't know if that $10 bill is real or not. Maybe it's not real, so how can I charge you $10 for something I don't know that's real? It leads to absolute common sense chaos.
The great Samuel Johnson was living right in the midst of all of this in England during the 18th century. Some of our listeners might be familiar with Johnson from Boswell's famous biography of him. Johnson was a lexicographer. In other words, he was an expert in dictionaries, in making dictionaries.
Mm.
And he was a kind of a traditionalist conservative thinker in a lot of ways. And this whole issue came up, you know, about realism versus idealism and this, that, and the other. And the idea that you can't know anything outside of your mind with any degree of certainty. And so I think if he actually did it or not, he might have done it. He walked up to a stone and he kicked it real hard. And, you know, it hurt. And so that's one way to find out that if there really is a stone outside of you, is to be confronted, you know, with reality. You might think you can jump off of the Sears Tower in Chicago and fly down. But if you jumped off of it, that's the last thing you're going to have coming before you splatter on the pavement down below. So, I mean, reality is that the laws of gravity is a reality that we have to abide by, whether you're a realist or an idealist.
It really destroyed the whole idea of we getting information that is valid, real, true from the Bible. Okay, well, Ron, our time is running out once again as we conclude our program for Understanding the Bible, a Catholic Approach to Interpreting Sacred Scripture. May God bless our audience always and in all ways.